the shots heard around the world, echoing throughout the 2016 campaign. This hour, we will speak of security, vulnerability, Islam, and homosexuality. But we will also look at changes on Capitol Hill, the economics of a solo UK, and the impressions of a writer who has been telling the stories of America for decades, the soft-spoken, laser-eyed Don DeLillo, later this hour. But first, what is familiar about the Orlando shooting is beginning to sink in all over America. How it is targeting Muslim Americans in reckless political rhetoric. The president went before the nation yesterday to try and shut down.
The reason I am careful about how I describe this threat has nothing to do with political correctness and everything to do with actually defeating extremism. If we fall into the trap of painting all Muslims with a broad brush and imply that we are at war with an entire religion, then we are doing the terrorist work for them.
The challenge of religion and politics at a young, confused, angry Muslim man with a gun who saw no future but murder and death contains so many themes of modern American life. But one stands out to 27-year-old Hussein Turk, a graduate of the UCLA Law School.
I guess what's familiar to me as an American is the mass destruction of life and the reckless disregard for safety that has become the new norm in this country.
It seems that Omar Mateen was twice married but also a regular at the gay club in Orlando he attacked with vicious violence and brutality, killing people he probably knew. One man reported to police that he had messaged with Mateen on a gay cruising app for up to a year. Sarah Elton-Towey, professor of comparative religion at Evergreen State College, joined our discussion with Hussein Turk about the challenge of inclusion of the gay community in the larger community of Islam.
Just this double bind that we find ourselves in as progressive Muslim voices, which is when we try to talk about issues facing those members of our community and some of the problems within the Muslim community, we're always as progressive sort of looking over our shoulder to make sure that those efforts aren't usurped by forces outside of our community that want to project all violence onto Muslims and try to pretend that it's not in any way their problem.
So, Sarah, on the one hand, you're looking out at the sort of dark implications of rhetoric like you would hear from a Donald Trump. And also you're looking out for people who need help so much, so keenly, that they are perhaps inclined to desperate acts of one kind or another. It's two poles there that you're vigilant for. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
So Hussein Turk, in your own sort of journey to determining your sexual identity, are there obstacles in the way if you're a Muslim?
There are obstacles in the way, I believe, for any queer person coming out in this day and age, especially if you're a queer person of color and have ties to an immigrant family from elsewhere. I think, though, that the challenge that Muslims as an entire community are facing today after the Orlando massacre is reclaiming our faith and redefining for ourselves what it means to be Muslim and what it means to follow the teachings of Islam without being told that we have these blanket prohibitions. We need to reinvigorate our own process, our own intellectual methodologies for determining what is and is not acceptable under Islam, rather than being spoon-fed these rules from Saudi Arabia without any critical examination. That's not to say that Islam itself is the cause of what happened. As Professor Antentawi mentioned, it's really nuanced, and we have to attack this problem from many perspectives. And one of those perspectives is, as the majority of moderate Muslims, really wrestling with our faith and our spirituality and our religion to figure out how we can make it not only more inclusive for queer people, but how we can make it more progressive and how we can reconstruct Islam as not this perpetual outsider or foreigner to Western progress, but as something that is that can go hand in hand with change and in modernity.
Professor Elton-Towey, Hussein Turk talks about the prescriptions and rules that are dictated from places like Saudi Arabia, but there's also a very strong prescriptive power that comes within the family, father to son, grandfather to father, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And it can be difficult to disaggregate culture from Islam. And then we also have to be careful when we say Islam. What do we mean by Islam? There's Islamic legal codes that many of which derive from the medieval period. But is it really the case that an individual Muslim, regardless of where they are and what their context is, are all following Islamic law to the letter as if it's a recipe book? Is that really the way that human beings operate? And I would argue no. I completely agree with Hussein. We have to do some very foundational work around really basic questions of Islamic penal law. Is this something that contemporary thinkers can reinterpret and re-enliven in ways that animate our particular moment? And one of the ironies here is that we as Muslims right now in the 21st century, if you look at the span of Islamic history, we're living in an age in which we are the least open-minded and the least willing to interpret our religion in a way that is going to correspond to our contemporary ethics and values.
Sarah, That is the key right there. If you believe that, then the combination of the violence in America that Hussein Turk has talked about, the access to guns that everyone has talked about since Orlando, becomes this toxic combination. And I'm seeing a fellow by the name of Omar Mateen wandering about with this horrible struggle, with this huge religious crisis going on, with all sorts of just terrible personality traits that are apparent to people around him. And nobody has the religious courage, it seems to me, to reach out to him and say, hey, pal, God loves you, or you're okay, or we're going to take care of you, something. I mean, maybe somebody did, and I don't even know about it. But it seems to me that there was a way of intervening there, and it just didn't happen. And maybe, you know, I'm projecting fantasy, but what do you think?
I think that's a really good point, actually, that it's a shame that there wasn't a religious space. I mean, I don't think that we can blame Islam for Omar Mateen's problems.
No.
However, I agree with you that if there was a religious space, a mosque, an environment in which this man, with all of his contradictions and self-hatred, could have walked in and felt loved and accepted, that would have been very helpful. And I think that that is not by and large the kind of – Hussein may want to weigh in on this. I'm assuming that's not the kind of greeting or the kind of culture – that many young queer Muslims or any Muslims that are having really serious contradictory problems might find in a mosque today. And
Hussein,
I think that is really a problem.
That's definitely true. I wasn't greeted with open arms by members of the Kalamazoo Islamic Center when I came out. But my first job looking back was to come out to myself and love myself. And once I did that, my family, members of my congregation, they all came to support me. So that to me is testament to the fact that at the core of Islam are the elements that are necessary for the kind of revitalization or reinvigoration of the principle or ethic of self-determination that I believe is central to Islam and I believe is what makes Islam so uniquely positioned to be a force for social justice and social change.
But what about intervening in this case, Hussein? What about somebody, some faithful person reaching out, you know, saying to Omar, hey, you know, think about what you're doing. And I don't mean think about what you're doing with your AR-15, but just think about what you're doing to the people around you kind of thing.
Again, we can only speculate. We don't know for sure what his mental state was. The FBI, as far as I know, has not yet concerned that he was indeed closeted or questioning his sexuality. So perhaps if there was someone whom he trusted in his circle of Muslims who said to him, no, stop, that of course could have had a change. But I think that rather than looking at just this individual event, we need to look also at the systems that are producing this phenomenon of terrorists and a few crazy bad seeds that are co-opting our faith. And not only does that have to work, does that work have to begin within the Muslim community, but also as Americans, we need to recognize that our foreign policy of going into the Muslim world and bombing countries and destroying civil society, destroying institutions of education and learning, is counter to our counter-terrorism position. It creates a power vacuum in which extremists and fundamentalists and people who have warped Islam can manipulate the minds of the masses and continue to keep Muslims following this version of Islam that I believe is untrue to the core and essence of what Islam really is.
The rhetoric from the campaign, both of you, before we go, what Donald Trump has said, does it make you feel more or less vulnerable as members of the faith?
It's absolutely terrifying to me. And I think that the rhetoric, the anti-Muslim, Islamophobic, xenophobic rhetoric that comes out after each of these events is growing more vitriolic, and we're seeing more of it, and that scares me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this rhetoric is highly cynical. I think that this is a disastrous moment in American politics, and I've been following Islamophobic trends since 9/11, and there's no question it's gotten exponentially worse. Donald Trump is really just single-handedly using not just racism and xenophobia against Muslims, but all kinds of marginalized communities in this country for his own cynical ends. And it is extremely dangerous. It's cynical. It's problematic. It really needs to stop.
Sarah Altantawi is a professor of comparative religion at Evergreen State College. Hussein Turk is a 27-year-old recent graduate of UCLA Law School, where he specialized in critical race studies. Hussein and Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Hussein.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.